You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Egypt's former president Hosni Mubarak wins his appeal against the life sentence he received over the deaths of demonstrators during Egypt's revolution. He also faces retrial over corruption charges on which he was originally acquitted. We'll have the latest from Cairo. China, according to somewhat startled economists, is now just 3 years from overhauling the United States to become the world's largest economy. So far during its long march to prosperity, China has seemed content to buy things and make things. What happens if they start wanting to run things?
The spectacular economic growth has also led to corruption, has also led to social inequality, has also led to the environment has deteriorated. So a lot of these things that were like the successes of the last period also now some of the difficulties of the next period.
In our weekly defence briefing, we'll find out, among other things, what Japan is buying with its burgeoning defence budget.
Japan is now increasingly concerned about China's rising power. And what Abe's done this week is he's requested $2 billion on top of the $53 billion that was planned for the defence budget. The first increase for the defence budget for about a decade.
Sticking with matters military, we'll explore Sweden's recent suggestion of a defence pact for Scandinavia by asking a member of Monocle staff for his recollections of soldiering in the snow.
Tell us briefly then, when you did your national service, on a scale of 1 to utterly boring, how dull was it?
From 1 to 10?
Yeah.
10 being most boring.
Yeah.
It was 9.5.
And Monocle's design editor will be joining us with his assessment of day one of the immense interior design and furniture fair, IMM, which began today in Cologne. All that plus a look at the imminent new print issue of Monocle, plus some music as well, all coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But before we get into all of that, the news with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The President of the European Council has expressed deep concern that Mali is seriously threatened by the actions of terrorists and rebels. Islamist rebels linked to Al-Qaeda launched a counter-offensive in central Mali after 4 days of airstrikes by French warplanes on their strongholds in the north. European Council President Herman Van Rompuy, on a visit to Cairo, said he'd discussed the conflict during his meeting with the head of the Arab League.
As regards recent developments in Mali, I reiterated the EU's deep concern with the actions of terrorists and rebel groups in that country, which pose a serious threat to its governability and are causing so much suffering among the population.
Lawyers representing accused in the Delhi gang rape case have blamed police for manipulating and delaying evidence in court and claiming that their clients had been falsely implicated. The five men who faced court on Monday are accused of raping the 23-year-old woman who died in Singapore 2 weeks after being beaten and gang raped on a moving bus in New Delhi on December the 16th. The UN Human Rights Commissioner Navi Pillay has called for an international investigation into decades of serious human rights abuses in North Korea. Ms. Pillay said it had one of the worst but least understood and reported human rights situations in the world. She added there had been no sign of progress under new leader Kim Jong-un. The two-day Asian Financial Forum has opened in Hong Kong. Some 2,000 business and government leaders from around the world are attending the event, which is dedicated to probe into methods tackling issues such as China opportunities, the future of the Eurozone, and the world's food and agriculture sector. Hong Kong Government Chief Executive Leung Chun Ying addressed at the opening ceremony, saying the forum provided an excellent platform for discussion.
We'll provide a platform, a common platform, for informed discussion on policy and for public-private collaboration. It will be an ambassador for the industry locally and overseas, and at the same time, a capacity builder.
The Australian Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer Wayne Swan focused on the need for growth.
We need to be looking at all the sources of growth in the global economy, including trade reforms, to kickstart growth so we can make some progress in creating further growth.
The African Union is seeking to defuse hostilities between Sudan and South Sudan that brought them close to war last year, and to end a freeze on oil exports that threatens to wreck their economies. South Sudan seceded from the North in 2011 after decades of wars, but border disputes and disagreements over oil pipeline fees have dragged on, delaying economic development. And an Italian court has denied the request of former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to halt a trial where he's accused of having sex with an underage prostitute. The court in Milan also decided it did not need to hear testimony from the woman, the dancer Karima El Mahroug. Mr. Berlusconi's lawyers requested the trial be halted while he runs in the current election campaign. Both he and Ms. Mahroug, better known by her stage name Ruby Heartstealer, have denied ever having sex. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. It's just gone 18.06 past the hour. 18.06 past the hour. 6 minutes past 18. 18 being the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. Now, by the standards of forcibly retired Middle Eastern dictators, former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak isn't doing too badly, which is to say that he's still in his own country and he's still alive. And his currently rather circumscribed retirement may be about to improve. A Cairo court has accepted an appeal against the prison sentence Mubarak received after being convicted over the deaths of protesters during the revolt which removed him. The court's decisions are not unalloyed good news for Mubarak. His two sons, Gamal and Alaa, had their acquittals on corruption charges overturned and will face retrial. And Mubarak himself will also be retried on similar charges. So what does all this mean for the former president and, rather more importantly, for the country now struggling to recover from his rule? First, this report from Cairo journalist and regular Monocle 24 contributor Abdul Rahman Hussein.
A Cairo court has accepted an appeal by deposed Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, which means that he will be retried for the killing of protesters during the January 2011 uprising that led to his ouster. Mubarak is to be retried alongside former Interior Minister Habib al-Adli and six of his aides. While Mubarak and al-Adli both received life sentences which they appealed, the six aides were acquitted and released. Although the court verdict granting a retrial may be seen in the context of regular legal procedure, it presents an opportunity for both supporters and detractors of the former dictator, who now spends his days under arrest in a military hospital. For the few supporters Mubarak still has, the opportunity for him to spend the remainder of his days outside prison hospital is appealing. However, the retrial also has repercussions in the political arena, presenting an opportunity to build a stronger case against Mubarak and the senior Interior Ministry officials for the violence perpetrated against protesters. It is also an opportunity for Mubarak's successor, the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi. The beleaguered Morsi would welcome strong convictions against the previous regime, especially as most police commanders on the ground during the revolt have also been acquitted. In a contentious decree he issued last November, Morsi ordered the retrial of Mubarak and other former regime stalwarts, only to later discover that by law new evidence was required for the retrial. An independent fact-finding commission has discovered that Mubarak followed events on a live feed at the presidential palace, contrary to claims of his defense that he knew nothing about it. Morsi had also contentiously removed Egypt's public prosecutor in a move that was seen as an attack on the independence of the judiciary, as Egyptian law prevents such a move. Morsi circumvented this by changing the law that governed the appointment of the post. Egypt's prosecution service had been severely criticized for building a weak case against Mubarak and his aides, and much of the blame was placed at the doorstep of the public prosecutor, a Mubarak appointment. However, Morsi's move did not have the requisite populist effect, as it was perceived to be more self-serving, for in the same decree he granted himself extraordinary powers and judicial immunity, privileges he extended to a Muslim Brotherhood-dominated constituent assembly that drafted Egypt's constitution.
And joining me now on the line is David Shanker, director of the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute. David, is this decision by the court surprising?
No, I don't think it is, actually. There had been an appeal in process for some time, and it was quite a controversial decision. They found a very odd way of sentencing Mubarak, not convicting him of murder, but of not preventing the deaths of hundreds. And then this is, you know, quite unusual. And I think, you know, his sentencing and Adli's sentencing, they're so high ranking that I think it's almost natural that there would have been some sort of appeal underway.
Does Mubarak actually have any kind of chance here, or is he just figuring, you know, he's 84 years old, he's not going anywhere, he might as well?
It seems to me that that he doesn't have much of a chance. You know, in fact, you know, one of the there's a great risk for him here, in fact, because, you know, when they sentence him to not having prevented the deaths of hundreds, some of the new evidence that they're going to bring is that he had actually been monitoring the protests all along, watching TV, knew what was happening, and didn't take steps, which of course, if he wasn't taking steps to prevent the deaths, that in fact it may further implicate him in the killing of these 800 or 900 protesters, and could get him hung, as well as you know, get Habib Adli hanged as well.
How far are pleas about his health likely to impress anybody?
You know, this is amazing. I think about 5 months ago, I actually wrote an obituary for Mubarak. This guy has lived a lot longer than anybody else could have predicted, you know, particularly given the fact that people believe that he has some sort of pancreatic or stomach cancer that he was treated in Germany for a few years back. I don't think that there's a whole great deal of sympathy for Mubarak that is going to weigh on the judges' minds here. You know, but the judiciary has been cowed of late by Mohamed Morsi, the new president, and so this may be, you know, in some senses, an even more confused and even more politically charged trial than the first time.
Does Mubarak and indeed his wider clan have any kind of constituency still in Egypt, or even any sort of nostalgic cachet?
Well, it's hard to say. What I would tell you is that you know, if you look at the election results where Mohamed Morsi was elected president of the country, he beat out a guy named Ahmed Shafiq, who was appointed by Mubarak some decades ago as his successor, as the chief of the Air Force, and he was a minister in Mubarak's government of civil aviation. He classifies as what Egyptians pejoratively call Falul, or the remnants of the former regime. This is who Morsi was running against for president, and Shafiq got, you know, 48-49% of the vote, you know, a former Mubarak appointee. I'm not sure people long for return of Mubarak, but there is some resonance of the stability, the secularism, the non-authoritarian religious nature of the former government that I think we're seeing now play out in the streets over the protests for this new Islamist court constitution that that Morsi pushed through in a non-democratic manner.
Unlikely though it may be, then, what would happen if Mubarak walked?
I can't imagine that he will walk. And of course, even if he doesn't get convicted for, reconvicted for the, on a stiffer sentence, for example, for not preventing the deaths of hundreds in Tahrir and elsewhere during the revolt, he will still be liable and no doubt resentenced, for corruption, that he received a lengthy sentence for as well. I find it hard to imagine that Mubarak will walk or see the light of day in his lifetime. But if he does, I think it would be, you know, even more divisive for Egypt. I think, you know, his trial and retrial is actually a welcome distraction for Mohamed Morsi, who is, you know, fighting this deteriorating economy and, you know, increased unpopularity of what he's doing in the country, facing a devaluation of the Egyptian pound. So to have this trial going is great for the Muslim Brotherhood leadership of the country right now. But nobody really wants to see this guy go free after the 30 years of authoritarianism.
David Schenker, Director of the Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute, thank you very much for joining us. Coming up, we'll be back to assess the significance of China's projected growth with Jonas Perello-Plesner of the European Council on Foreign Relations.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalizing the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Well within living memory, China was substantially agricultural, chronically undereducated, and an overwhelmingly poor country, burdened by an unmanageably vast population and boneheaded adherence to the contents of a small red volume collating the rantings of a maniac. In the last few decades, however, China has embarked on a transformation as notable for its speed as its magnitude. The country is now on course to overhaul the United States as the world's largest economy as soon as 2016, much quicker than most experts had predicted. But will this burgeoning economic power and confidence manifest itself in an increasing desire to lead the world? It's a question brought into sharp focus by the recent passing on of leadership to a new generation. Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke to Jonas Perello-Plesner of the European Council on Foreign Relations about what we might expect in the coming year from what some are calling China 3.0.
Let's start with the title of this book, China 3.0. What is China 3.0 and how have we got here?
Well, I mean, the reason why we picked China 3.0 for this collection of essays is basically wanted to show how China moved through different phases, and the first being sort of the China 1.0 with Mao and the revolution, and the second then being China 2.0 with Deng Xiaoping and all the market reforms. And basically they've come to the end of that period and now sort of new, more uncertain period opened, where a lot of the what was in the second period, the successes, the growth, the spectacular economic growth has also led to corruption, has also led to social inequality, has also led to the environment has deteriorated. So a lot of these things that were like the successes of the last period also now some of the difficulties of the next period.
Now, as you say, you use the word uncertain, which I think most people probably use when they look at what's going to happen over the next 5 years. Now we've had this leadership transition. When you look at the seven men who have been chosen to lead China through this next stage, what are the signs that you see that show us what direction they may well go in?
Well, I mean, there are many different ways you can sort of read them. I think we've seen signs that they want to continue reform. We saw Xi Jinping, the new sort of leader of China, that went down to the southern part of China, Guangdong, which sort of harked back to Deng Xiaoping, who also made a similar southern tour of showing when he wanted to kickstart reforms that had slowed at the beginning of the 90s. So in that sense, we have signs that they want to do economic reforms. On the other hand, we also see sort of clumsy propaganda still working in China, like we've just seen it these last weeks with the Southern Weekly, a Chinese newspaper that got changed its editorial newspaper, its New Year's editorial. So, I mean, we see all these sort of mixed, I would say, signals of where China is heading. And basically, if I return to the book, what we really wanted to do with this one was also to show all that complexity of by using Chinese thinkers and public intellectuals to show the sort of many different versions of where is China heading and give Europeans a sort of glimpse into that debate. Because very often we think, well, China is an authoritarian state, so it's easy to explain. There's like no debate. Everything you need to know is sort of like what the party says. But in reality, there's a huge debate underneath of where are we going now. And it might even sometimes be larger than what we're used to in Western democracies, where we all take democracy for given, we all take liberal international order for given. All these things are debated at the moment in China. What should we take part in internationally? How should we develop our own sort of society?
And do you think that European policymakers have enough of a grasp of what's really going on inside China at the moment?
No, I think too easily we see it then either just as authoritarian, and it's all a question of sort of improving human rights and they should change their system, and then it would be a different thing. And we don't know sort of the complexity. I mean, many Chinese provinces basically are the size of European countries. So I think in the next period, we need to know China much better also inside China, basically saying there is not if you look at it commercially, there's just not just one Chinese market. There's like, you have a Shanghai that's basically with middle class at the same time as in Europe. Then you have sort of hinterlands that are underdeveloped on a completely different market. So that's one sort of commercially, but it's the same thing also politically, that it's a very sort of different, and culturally a very different scene around. So getting to know China means also getting to know the sort of complexity of China.
Is part of the problem in terms of getting to know China the fact that, you know, when we look at the way, you know, the media often covers China, I mean, you know, here at Monocle we have contributors in Shanghai and Beijing, we have a bureau in Hong Kong, we have people going in and out all the time, but across many other mainstream media organisations, they might have a Beijing bureau, but that's it.
Well, yeah, I think that's part of the story, is that we've discovered China and know now it's big, will be part of a shaping part of the 21st century. But then sort of going into the more sort of details, that sort of Chongqing, I think, is a good example. This is the world's largest city. It's not very well known. It became a little bit known last year because of the whole affair of Bo Xilai, one of the sort of top leaders of China that sort of fell in a big corruption.
Yeah, not a thing to be known for, though, is it?
No. But I mean, still, it is the world's largest city, and it's not part of our sort of imaginary or our sort of knowledge of the world in the same way that we know sort of California is part of and Hollywood and all these sort of symbols. And in a sense, I mean, China has a lot of large sort of very sort of unknown cities and unknown provinces that are there to be sort of discovered as well.
When you look ahead to the next 5 years, with Xi Jinping taking over, so the next month or so, what do you think will be the key things for us to look at to see in which direction China is going to develop?
Well, I think there are probably three. One, of course, is economy. Will he be able to sort of take economic reforms forward that had sort of slightly stalled so much that some of the authors in this book talked about sort of the lost decade, actually, with Hu and Wen, which can be slightly paradoxical because it's been a decade as well with very high growth. But it's also been one where a lot of probably necessary reforms in the economic field has been just been pushed ahead to sort of the next generation. So will he be able to deal with that? Then I think expectations really is a big thing, because you have a sort of a middle class, a growing middle class. You have a much more vibrant discussion on the Chinese internet, on Chinese Twitter, Weibo. Will he be able to deal with all these expectations? There's an expectation now that the sort of new leadership will come up with something. And if in a sense it is also not just him, but a sort of seven person and a larger party that leads the country, If they end up in a relatively conservative mold of just continuing a lot of the same thing, I think there can be an expectation gap between a population expecting as well that China will change into sort of a new China 3.0 in the next period.
That was Steve Bloomfield speaking to Jonas Perello-Plesner of the European Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up, our defence expert brings us his weekly wrap-up of global military developments. And it is, as hinted just a few seconds ago, now time for our defence briefing with Monocle's man with his eye on all things military, Trevor Moss. Before discussing developments in America, Africa and Asia, our news editor Tom Edwards asked Trevor what effect Japan's budgetary increases would have on relations in the region.
Well, the background is that Japan hasn't increased its defence budget for about 10 years, and its allies, chiefly the US, have really started to despair, saying that Japan will, you know, lose the ability to defend itself, and that its defense industry will just wither away. But of course, Japan is now increasingly concerned about China's rising power, and recently elected a more hawkish government led by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And what Abe's done this week is he's requested $2 billion on top of the $53 billion that was planned for the defense budget. Obviously, that's not a huge increase, but it is very significant because it's the first increase for the defense budget for about a decade. And really what this signals is that Tokyo has really recognized it, that the situation just couldn't go on any longer. China's defense budget, growing by about 10% every year, already tripled Japan's. Japan can't really hope to keep pace with those increases, but it can at least now start increasing its budget, increasing its capabilities, and just trying to maintain some kind of parity with the Chinese.
And tell us about what the increase will actually go towards. I mean, are there specific things to address, for example, the threat from, you know, Chinese naval activities, for example?
Well, the thing they've really outlined so far is that they want to spend about $1 billion of that money upgrading their radar systems and airborne surveillance systems. And that's really just to keep track of what China's Navy is doing in those disputed areas. Also looking perhaps at expanding the armed forces, which were previously set to shrink. And also what Japan's looking at doing is using some of the cash to help its allies in the region, in particular the Philippines, which Japan has just promised to deliver 10 patrol ships to. The Philippines, of course, like Japan, very concerned about China's growing strategic power. So those are the two things we're really going to see with that extra money. And possibly next year we'll see another increase and Japan looking to do something else.
And just finally on this point, you mentioned Abe, the new administration. He's heading to the US shortly. What do you think will characterize the Japanese alliance with the US? Will there be, you know, a particular emphasis? Will the US be keen to, you know, recommend Japan, pursue certain actions? Well, how will that relationship be characterized, do you think, under the Abe administration?
Well, there's been some drift in the relationship under the previous administration. And I think what Abe's keen to do is really put the focus back on the US-Japan axis to really come out in support of the US pivot to Asia, which has maybe focused on other countries so far. He'll be keen to tell Obama that Japan is very keen to be a key partner in the US strategy to up its Asian presence. And he'll just be looking to reassure the US, which until now hasn't really been that convinced that Japan is on board.
Trevor, I'd like to shift our sights across to Africa now. And in the last few days and ongoing on Monocle 24, we've been covering a lot about Mali, also in the Democratic Republic of Congo, a lot of insurrections and lack of stability. But a new uprising in the Central African Republic is something we've looked at once or twice. Tell us what the latest is here.
Well, as you mentioned, I mean, these are pretty grim times in Africa, which we've already seen a lot of instability in the places you mentioned. And now we have this new armed uprising in the Central African Republic. This is traditionally a very unstable part of the region, but for the last 5 years, things have been looking fairly stable after the government led by President Francois Bozize signed a peace deal with the various rebel groups there. But that's all started to unravel over the last few weeks. These rebel groups have accused Bozize of reneging on his commitments. They've clubbed together to form this new rebel alliance called Seleka, which has really swept across the country, really capturing a lot of towns and is close to threatening the capital now, Bangui. But what's happened this week, which is perhaps good news, is that the rebels have just agreed to a week-long ceasefire. This comes after a lot of international pressure, some peacekeeping troops coming in from around the region, in particular Chad, and also this week from South Africa. And what they're looking at doing now is in this window of opportunity, this ceasefire, getting round the table and hopefully getting Bozize and the rebels to maybe reset and go back to what they agreed 5 years ago.
And Trevor, switching our sights finally to North America, looking at Canada and a potential bid of theirs to acquire a number of fighter jets. Tell us who's involved in this, you know, possible sale of these aircraft to the Canadians.
Well, this is a big story which we discussed late last year, which is that the Canadian government, which had been due to order the F-35, which is this new developmental stealth fighter, very expensive and overdue aircraft. They said they were resetting that procurement and opening the door to some other cheaper options. So the suppliers of those other cheaper options are now really in marketing overdrive in Canada. They are Boeing, Eurofighter and Dassault from France. The F-35 is still on the table, but it's very expensive and it probably doesn't suit Canada's requirements very well. It needs, you know, a long-range aircraft that can patrol the huge Arctic territory that it has. So really, Boeing, which supplies the F-18 Super Hornet is probably the favorite now, because the Canadian Air Force already operates the Hornet, which is the older, more basic version of the Super Hornet. And it's also the cheapest aircraft, and Canada is obviously very cost-conscious. And I think most analysts are saying that Boeing is, you know, having been completely out of the running, is now probably in the box seat to clinch this one.
Trevor Moss there talking to Tom Edwards. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll catch up with our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, who is wandering a furniture fair in Cologne, and learn how to run a modern revolution. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The President of the European Council has expressed deep concern that Mali is seriously threatened by the actions of terrorists and rebels. Islamist rebels linked to Al-Qaeda launched a counter-offensive in central Mali after 4 days of airstrikes by French warplanes on their strongholds in the north. Lawyers representing the accused in the Delhi gang rape case have blamed police for manipulating and delaying evidence in court and claiming that their clients had been falsely implicated. The five men who faced court on Monday are accused of raping the 23-year-old woman who died in Singapore 2 weeks after being beaten and gang raped on a moving bus in New Delhi on December the 16th. The UN Human Rights Commissioner Navi Pillay has called for an international investigation into decades of serious human rights abuses in North Korea. Ms. Pillay said it had one of the worst but least understood and reported human rights situations in the world. The African Union is seeking to defuse hostilities between Sudan and South Sudan that brought them close to war last year, and to end a freeze on oil exports that threatens to wreck their economies. South Sudan seceded from the North in 2011 after decades of wars, but border disputes and disagreements over oil pipeline fees have dragged on, delaying the economic development. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 18:31 here in London. Issue 60 of Monocle magazine will be on a newsstand near you very shortly. This issue takes as its key theme what we like to think is an underlying theme of every issue of Monocle: how things can be made better. In order to figure that out, the new issue goes out of its way to meet people who have been getting on with stuff, often unobtrusively but always effectively. Our subjects include party-free politicians, online campaigners, urban activists, and entrepreneurs in fields ranging from Scottish knitwear to Chilean olive oil. And in search of tips on how to run a modern revolution, Monocle's Joseph Dana spoke to Cairo collective Mozarine. Joseph joins me now. Joseph, what were the key lessons Mozarine had learnt from their experience helping to organise the Egyptian revolution?
Well, it was actually a very fascinating process looking at the work of Mozarine. Basically, what they're trying to do is kind of step into Egyptian society in place of this kind of, you know, gap of authority that exists in Egypt, and document exactly what is going on in the revolution, what has gone on in the revolution, and what continues to unfold on the streets of Cairo and Alexandria and Suez. And so they're really kind of bringing citizen journalism to the Egyptian society, basically, which is quite a big task for 80 million people.
What resources did Mozarine start with, which I guess is asking if you want to follow in their footsteps, what do you actually need?
Well, Mozarine is mostly citizen journalists, photographers, and online activists, people that are using social media platforms to spread a certain narrative about what is happening in Egypt as the revolution unfolds. And so what they told me is that in order to get the revolution online, in order to kind of preserve the revolution on these social media platforms like YouTube and Facebook and whatnot, they had to get offline. And so what they've been doing is holding public screenings in Tahrir Square in Cairo and teaching, you know, just kind of ordinary Egyptians how to use, you know, their phone to make a YouTube video, how to get online, how to kind of bring their voice into the kind of greater pot of voices that have been really shaping the Egyptian society since the revolution.
What did they learn about the limits of media activism, especially in a country as poor and substantially illiterate as Egypt is?
Well, looking at the situation in Egypt from the West, it's very tempting to kind of say this is a social media revolution and that all Egyptians have some sort of access and some sort of presence on these platforms. But what Mozarine found out is that this is not the case. In a country of 80 million people, at best you have maybe 5 million that have real kind of internet presence. And so that has really been the biggest challenge of training these, you know, legions of Egyptians that are living in Upper Egypt or in these kind of forgotten corners, which, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood has been very good at kind of mobilizing these people and kind of, you know, for the activists, for the Mosserian kind of collective to jump in there and mobilize them, you know, in their own ways of documenting their own kind of perspectives and what's happening on the ground. And so it's been a very interesting process to watch how they've done this and how they've kind of spread this message.
Is what Mosserine learnt from their experience in the Egyptian Revolution applicable everywhere?
Well, absolutely. I think that's definitely the case. You know, a lot of the things that they kind of informed me as I was researching the article were quite obvious. You know, one of the major themes that I heard was you have to be patient. You know, revolutions take a very long time. Egypt is not going to change overnight. And so you really have to kind of play the long game. You have to establish a very strong kind of structure and presence and authority, as it were, in order to really get that kind of, you know, necessary support and respect from Egyptian society. And so that's, you know, one of the you know, quite obvious, you know, aspects of their work, which is not always so apparent when we're looking at the situation from the West. Another situation that they kind of told me about was just this gap of authority, that they feel that no information is kind of useless, and they need to, you know, kind of preserve and record everything they possibly can, because the state in Egypt, the normal structures that preserve this kind of historical material just don't exist, or they're not functioning right now. And so that is something that's very, very important to their work.
You talked there about playing the long game, but how difficult are they finding it to maintain enthusiasm now that, I guess, the excitement of the revolution is over, and the revolution certainly, by the standards of their ambitions, was substantially a failure?
Right, exactly. But, you know, there are still these dramatic street battles that they told me whenever something like this happens, you know, during the kind of street battles that unfolded near the presidential palace recently in response to Morsi's kind of decrees and the constitutional debate, you know, this really provides a jolt to their work. It provides a new enthusiasm to get out there and to document exactly what is unfolding on the streets of Cairo. The other kind of aspect that they told me is that they also want to kind of agitate what's going on. One of their members, a guy named Omar Robert Hamilton, said, look, we're trying to keep the revolution boiling over through any platform we can. If we can come up with a new, you know, very sharp YouTube video that captures some very dramatic aspect in this long, you know, drawn out struggle that's happening in Cairo, this is, you know, incredibly beneficial for our work. We can screen this in Tahrir, and we can have new people look and reflect on you know, where Egypt has come from and how this whole process, this historical process, has unfolded.
Joseph Dana, thank you very much as ever for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
On Monocle's culture show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Our next item will take us to Scandinavia, and by way of fanfare, from Finland, this is Joe Stance with Hey Girl.
You're the one, don't.
That was Joe Stant with Hey Girl, and you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. Now, the generally placid outlook of the Scandinavian countries has not stopped them from developing regional rivalries. You don't need to spend long in any of them before hearing some variation of the joke about how the one thing country X has that country Y doesn't is good neighbours. However, Sweden's foreign minister and defence minister have both suggested recently that it might be worth discussing pooling Scandinavia's resources in the event of menace by a common enemy. But who might this invader be, and how much of a scrap could the combined legions of Sweden, Finland, Norway and Denmark offer them? Monocle's own former Finnish soldier, Marcus Hippi, discussed this with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, earlier today.
There is something interesting going on in the Nordic countries now. There is something in the air. This whole discussion started, I think it was January the 4th, when the Supreme Commander of the Swedish Armed Forces, Sverker Göransson, said that if someone was to attack Sweden, the country could protect itself only for 1 week.
That's
and after
not
that,
long.
And after that, it would need help from other countries. That is not long at all. But you know what Finland, what happened in Finland after that? There was a professor of the military academy over there. His name is Alpo Juntunen. And he said that if Russia was to attack Finland, Finland would only be able to protect southern parts of the country. And considering the military equipment Russia has today, in the worst case scenario, Finland could only last for a few hours.
A few hours?
A few hours.
Russia doesn't have very good tanks anymore.
On the other hand, when you think of the resources and when you think of the population, Finland with 5.4 million people against Russia with 142 million people.
Yeah.
That gives you some kind of an idea
the
of the
odds are against
as well.
Now, how seriously are people in Finland, Sweden and elsewhere in the Nordic region actually taking this debate? Is there a serious undertone to this, or do people just think, oh, listen, it doesn't matter because, let's face it, the Russians aren't coming anymore?
I think there's a big difference between the attitude in Sweden and in Finland. Actually, the Swedish defence minister already responded at one point that the current level of preparedness was appropriate given the credibility of an attack, which means that Sweden doesn't really think anyone is going to attack them. On the other hand, Finland, it's been 70 years since the Second World War, since the war against Russia, and there are quite many people in that country still who actually consider Russia to be a threat on some level. And therefore, there is some concern on how the Finnish military could do. This professor who said that Finland wouldn't last for long, he said that air forces in Finland are up to the standards at the moment, but the problem actually is with the ground forces and the Finnish Navy.
So now we've got defence ministers and foreign ministers within several of these countries now talking to each other and suggesting, well, perhaps are there some ways that we can have some sort of Nordic force? I saw just yesterday Sweden has taken over the chairmanship of the Nordic Council and is saying the big thing for this year is military, it's defence, it's about how we work together.
Interestingly, yes. After that discussion, both in Finland and in Sweden, there was a new opening from Sweden. Sweden's Foreign Minister Carl Bildt and Defence Minister Karin Engström actually suggested that Sweden could start buying shared military equipment with other Nordic countries. And actually, for practical reasons, it would be the easiest to do this with Finland alone, because Sweden and Finland are the only countries out of the Nordic countries that are not members of the NATO.
Although it's interesting that Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former Danish Prime Minister, now Secretary General of NATO, is in Stockholm today meeting with Carl Bildt. And when we interviewed him for the magazine about 3 or 4 months ago, he was talking about how NATO members should be readjusting to the fact that all their defence budgets are cutting. He said, look, it doesn't actually matter that much so long as they all work together, so long as not everyone tries to buy an aircraft carrier. And someone goes, okay, well, look, you buy this, we'll sort that out, and we're good on, with our air force.
Exactly. Finland is not quite ready for Nordic military cooperation, according to the Prime Minister, what he said today. But the Prime Minister really has given positive signal when it comes to buying equipment together. In Finland, this professor who actually warned about the Finnish military preparedness for an attack, he doesn't really believe that the European Union would be of any help in the situation that someone was to attack Finland.
No. I think that's
even though like many people actually still do think so in Finland.
Well, there is supposed to be under the Lisbon Treaty. There is supposed to be a defence agreement, or there is a defence agreement, just hasn't been enacted on, which would create a far stronger rapid reaction force that would actually be able to do something in terms of military. I don't think defending Finland was sort of on the list of things it was going to do. Do you? You know, you did your time within the Finnish military.
Have been there.
You've done your national service, and based on the stories you tell about what you had to do, I'm not entirely sure Finland can be completely safe in your hands. Do you get the sense that a lot of countries in the Nordic region aren't quite sure what to do with their militaries anymore? Because let's face it, the Russians aren't coming.
Absolutely. They don't really. Sweden has been trying to think of a new function for their military. Basically, they want to go quite much go into peacekeeping abroad. Finland is kind of in between. Finland's attitude is quite funny. They don't really want to interrupt, go into many foreign adventures with their military. At the same time, they still want to have a lot of equipment in the country. They're still, you know, in Finland, we never say who the enemy is that we get prepared for, but you know, pretty much everyone knows.
But everyone knows.
Yes.
Tell us briefly then, when you did your national service. On a scale of 1 to utterly boring, how dull was it?
From 1 to 10?
Yeah.
10 being most boring.
Yeah.
It was 9.5.
What was a normal day like for you then?
The normal day was we wake up in the morning, we go for a jog, then we have breakfast.
Sorry, go for a jog. How cold was it?
It was not always cold. Sometimes minus 10, sometimes plus 10.
Okay.
That's what you get in Finland. After that, we would have some basic training during the first 3 months. But after the first 3 months, I was sent to a military airbase, and my job was to take photos. That wasn't that useful.
But anything interesting?
The basic training session was interesting. We went to forest, and we fought against the enemy that wasn't named.
The enemy that wasn't named.
Yeah, according to one simulation, there were black helicopters that arrived from behind the eastern border of Finland, but we still didn't name who the enemy were.
Marcus Hippie reminiscing on his days in uniform with Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. In just a moment, we will be hearing from our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, who is working the rooms of Cologne's International Furniture Trade Show. But first, here's Little Dragon with Ritual Union. Little Dragon there with Ritual Union. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. And IMM, Germany's biggest furniture trade fair, kicks off today in Cologne. 1,200 companies from more than 50 countries are exhibiting. And among the people roaming its halls is Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, who joins me now. Hugo, good evening. First of all, give us a sense of the scale of this thing. It sounds vast.
Well, it's Germany's biggest furniture trade fair, and it happens in Cologne, which is one of Germany's smaller, medium-sized cities. And I've been coming to this fair for 7 or maybe 8 years now, and it's been growing steadily year on year. And this year, it's really reached capacity. It's taking up all 12 halls of Cologne's fairground space, which each hall has 3 floors, and there's a lot of chairs to work your way through.
Plenty of places to sit while you do it, though, of course. What is the reason that it has just becoming or been getting steadily bigger, even in a time of alleged European recession?
I think it's partly because everybody sees the strength of Germany's economy, and also their domestic spend is far bigger than probably any other country in Europe. So whereas in the past everybody looked on Cologne as being the fair that kicked off the year, everybody was a little bit reticent to unveil their big product launches. Over the last few years, having seen that actually maybe it's a market that people should be taking a little bit more seriously, all the southern Europeans, particularly the Italian furniture manufacturers, have been flocking in their droves. And this year there's more than ever. Like I say, the fair is at capacity. And as is the city, there isn't a hotel room or a seat in a restaurant for love nor money. So I'm actually staying in Düsseldorf, which is like 40 minutes on the train away, along with many other fair attendees.
So what are some of the major draws this year that are pulling all those people in?
Well, a lot of the focus has been on this big kitchen exhibition that they roll out every 2 years. And the Germans are fantastic kitchen manufacturers. They have some of global leaders in not just Europe, but around the world, with companies like Bulltope and Miele. And this year, everybody's talking about the future of the kitchen, which is more interesting than it sounds, but it's mind-boggling in that you walk around endless stands of kitchen appliances being shown devices that look a little bit like iPods incorporated into cooking things that can do everything and the washing up together. And you just wonder really who can afford to have these sorts of things in their homes. But there is a market that these stands were absolutely packed, and mainly with Chinese buyers, it seems, which is the next big target on all of these German manufacturers.
Isn't there kind of a risk of overcomplicating things? I mean, what do you actually need from a kitchen other than that it makes things hotter than they previously were?
This is my big question as well. And, you know, if you have a power cut or something, or if there's a technical fault and you can't swivel your little dial around to get the cooker to heat up to 180 degrees, then what do you do? But people feel quite sure that their technology is very, very resilient and will last and not outdate as well, which is the other thing. So as soon as you pack everything into sort of a technological interface, you'd think sort of in 5 years' time it's probably redundant. But they assure me that they have technology up to the mark for at least the next 20 years. I don't know, I'd still prefer the old-fashioned knob that you can turn.
And just finally, what are you most looking forward to seeing in the rest of your time there?
Well, I'm here with many different missions, but tomorrow I'm going to visit Central Mosque, which is just nearing completion. And this is being built in the Ehrenfeld district of Cologne. And it's going to be the biggest mosque in Northern Europe when it completes, and has been incredibly controversial. But if anybody's interested, they can talk, or they can hear me talking about it tomorrow evening after I've spoken to the mayor who's pushed this through and to the architect.
Hugo, thank you very much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of the fair. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And that is all we have time for today's show. Thanks to our producer, Ala John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Coming up next, it's Culture with Robert Bound. He'll be speaking to James Kuno, president of the Getty Trust, about art and architecture in Los Angeles and the Pacific Standard Time exhibition.
The origin of Pacific Standard Time was our recognition that there was a series of artists who came into prominence after the Second World War and developed new ways of making art and gave a national prominence to the city of Los Angeles as a capital for the production of the visual arts.
3 hours from now, at 2200 hours here in London, Ted Kravitz and I will be back for the Monocle Daily, and Ted will be back on his own with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. For now, though, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.